Okay, over to you, Francis.
Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to this 83rd webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation Webinars, and webinar series in progress as shown here. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. So, you know, if you miss a session, you can always go back and pick it up. You can also access any of these webinars on the homepage of Moria Federation up here in the upper left-hand corner. Okay, this month we have just a one-page passage from old diary leaves. So could we get a reader? Start us off.
An instructive experiment was made by Mr. Archer, RA, at my request, which is worth reporting. We discussed the theory of visualizing in connection with the real or pretended method ascribed to William Blake, Irish painter mystic, who, it is alleged, would paint a portrait after a single sitting. He having the faculty of visualizing his sitter in the pose desired, and thus being able to paint from the astral phantom as if it were the living flesh. Mr. Archer had never tried it, but said he would if I would pose for 15 minutes. I took my place and he steadfastly looked at me, now and again closing his eyes to fix the image better upon his sensorium, after which I was dismissed and asked to return after 3 days. When I went again to his studio, he had sketched in my portrait, and we were both greatly interested to see how he had retained parts of the face and lost others. As in an experiment, it was valuable in its suggestiveness. Mr. Archer finished the portrait and is now at our London headquarters.
Thank you, BL. So I looked everywhere for this portrait and I couldn't find it. Yeah. The drawing shown here is was drawn in 2020 by Travis Simpkins. The artist that Olcott cites, quote, Mr. Archer, R.A., was probably a Scotsman named James Archer, who lived from 1822 to 1904, so the timing is right. And I'm basing this assignation on the fact that Archer was Olcott's contemporary, had a Royal Academy title, the RA after his name, and occasionally painted Indian subjects. So it's not definitive, but there's a real good chance there's not that many artists of, you know, one particular name in a certain period of time. So I would bet that this was him. I would really like to see this painting, but I couldn't find it anywhere. Okay. Anyway, we began our last session with a look at the Aurora Australis and Aurora Borealis, which modern science tells us are caused by the interaction of solar wind with the Earth's magnetic field and atmosphere, but are esoterically considered to be photic demonstrations of intelligent electricity. There's no reason that both of these things can't be mutually true. We then took a look at MPH's commentary on verse 6, which we finished last time, before moving on to verse 7. HPB's commentary on verse 7 begins by listing the 7 stages of progressive densification of the Earth chain globes, which reaches its densest point in globe D of the 4th round, our current planet Earth. These seven stages are the homogeneous, which means all one substance, the aeriform, the nebulous, the ethereal, the germinal, vapory, and dense physical. We then took a look at what theosophy considers to be the length of a quote unquote eternity, also described as 100 years of Brahma, which DK tells us is the period of a solar system. Now, whether that's one incarnation of a solar logos or the entire unfoldment of all the lives of a solar system, he doesn't say. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. We also discussed various cosmic periods of time. But if you're interested in that, you can always listen to the last session. So next we begin the commentary on the second half of verse 7. That part of that verse reads, reach the fourth fruit of the fourth path of knowledge that leads to nirvana, and thou shalt comprehend, for thou shalt see. So can we get a reader for the commentary on this B section of verse 7, please?
Vivian, can you read that, please?
B. There are four grades of initiation mentioned in exoteric works, which are known respectively in Sanskrit as Skrotapanna, or Sagada, a big guess, Anagamin, and Ahan, the four paths to Nirvana. In this, our fourth round bearing the same appellations. The Ahan, though he can see the past, the present, and the future, is not yet the highest initiate. For the adept himself, the initiated candidate, becomes chela, pupil, to a higher initiate. Three further higher grades have to be conquered by the Arhan, who would reach the apex of the ladder of arhatship. There are those who have reached it even in this fifth race of ours, but the faculties necessary for the attainment of these higher grades will be fully developed in the average ascetic only at the end of this root race and in the sixth and seventh.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay, first up, there are four grades of initiation mentioned in exoteric works, which are known respectively in Sanskrit as Skrotopanna, Sagardagan, Anagaman, and Arhan, four paths to Nirvana, in this, our fourth round, bearing the same appellation. So, yeah, this last phrase is interesting, suggesting he's correlating these directly to these four paths to Nirvana in this fourth round. So it's conditioned by fourth round reality. These could shift that which is needed in order to follow these paths. DK tells us is ever shifting. So in the next round, the stakes would be higher. The requirements would shift. So Skrotapanna refers to the first stage of enlightenment in Theravada Buddhism. It translates as stream enterer. That's what it means, indicating someone who has entered the stream that leads to Nirvana. A Skrotapanna has eradicated the first three of what Buddhism considers to be the 10 fetters that bind beings to the cycle of rebirth or samsara. These are, first one of these fetters is belief in a permanent personality, personality-oriented self. The second is vikikicca, doubt or uncertainty, especially regarding the Buddha's teachings. Three, silabhata paramasa, attachment to rites and rituals. By the way, the images are just for fun here. The second stage of enlightenment in Buddhism is called Sakadagami, meaning once returner. A Sakadagami has significantly weakened the fourth and fifth fetters, which are kamachanda, sensual desire, and vayapada, ill will. The third stage is called anagami, which is Pali for non-returner. And anagami has eradicated the first of the first five of the 10 fetters that bind beings to the cycle of rebirth, samsara, and will, according to Theravadic Buddhist tradition, not be reborn in the human realm or any lower realms, but will be reborn in a higher, more refined realm called the pure abodes or Sudhavasa, where they will attain full enlightenment. Finally, the fourth stage, called by HPB Arhan, is more widely called Arhat, which in Theravada Buddhism refers to a person who has reached the highest stage of enlightenment. An Arhat has completely eradicated all 10 fetters that bind beings to the cycle of rebirth, samsara, and has attained nirvana. These last five fetters are rupa raga, craving for fine material existence, passion for form. Avrupa raga, craving for immaterial existence, passion for what is formless. Mana, conceit, and udhakka, restlessness. And finally, avijja, ignorance. So we might roughly correlate these four stages with the first four initiations described by DK, though there is much variation between Theravada Buddhism and Theosophy as to the particular qualities gained at initiation. Also, I have to say that this fourth stage is described as is complete liberation. And we know through Theosophy that this is, though you can attain liberation from the personality vehicles, that the path continues. And, you know, the master of wisdom becomes the Chohan, who then becomes the seventh initiate. And then there's the eighth and ninth, and then there's graduation beyond this solar system through the seven cosmic paths that take you to cosmic existence, where there are cosmic initiations. So there you have to take this idea of final emancipation with a grain of salt. The phrase, the four paths to nirvana, in this, our fourth round, bearing the same appellations, suggests that there is a sequential relationship between the first four rounds of this chain and these four stages of initiation, even to the point that the rounds bear the same name. This is a continuation of HPB's comparison of the macro and microcosmic realities. Okay, just want to remind you all that dialogue is more interesting than monologue. So anytime any of you have any questions, thoughts about the subject matter, please feel free. I see a hand.
Yes, go ahead, please, Nadal.
One of them, of the fetters, I think it said, was attachment to ritual. I recall reading it somewhere in the blue books that we have to be attached to ritual, even as a protection amongst the devas' evolution, and that the seventh ray is about ritual in a certain sense.
Yes, well, until a certain point, right? You use a form until it no longer serves. So, yeah, it's this number three here, Silibata Paramasa. So when you reach a certain stage where that which is gained through ritual is intrinsically, you become intrinsically aware, then the attachment to the outer forms of rites and rituals no longer is necessary. In fact, there's a certain stage where the rituals themselves are no longer necessary, though you might participate in them for the benefit of others, right? So it's not so much about the rites and rituals themselves. It's a subtle distinction, but rather the attachment to them, to the form of rite and ritual. And see, we're looking at, I think this is a second stage. No, a third stage. So this is a fairly high state of becoming that this, where this stage would be reached. Thank you for your question. Anybody else? Okay.
I was noticing ignorance as one of them.
Right, if
That was it,
last one.
yeah. How could
How could it be the last
baffles
one?
me? Yeah, the ignorance.
Yeah.
How can we have any ignorance about anything?
Wait a minute. How can we have any ignorance about anything?
Well, no, like, let's see if I can speak correctly. There's just so much more to learn. And of course, you're ignorant before you learn it.
That's right. And I think this is, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. You're
Yeah,
finished.
no, that was what I was
Okay.
questioning. It's like there's so much to learn. How could you,
I think
you've never get it before?
this ignorance has to do with the lower quaternary, the three sheaths, the physical, astral, and mental sheaths, and the condition of Maya, glamour, and illusion that life in the lower quaternary creates, and that could be called in its sum total ignorance. However, again, just like the other point with ritual, that it's a continuously unfolding reality because, a solar logos is going to be quote unquote ignorant of the reality of certain cosmic logoi. But of course, that's not what's meant here. So that's where I would place this stage, especially because an arhat is a fourth initiate. It's, DK very specifically names this stage. And a fourth initiate frees himself. It's the fourth initiation is one of liberation and frees himself from all aspects of what are called the chains of samsara, which are the three lower sheaths, and it's able to escape onto the Buddhic plane. I think that's what's meant by this term.
Okay, thank you so much. That
Yeah, you're welcome.
answers my question.
Oh,
Thanks.
great. Yeah. I mean, some of these are really odd. You would think, for instance, that the fourth initiate would have left behind restlessness, a long time ago, that there would be a certain peace. But there's real teaching in this. It's possible that that this quality also, by the way, the translations are going to be cursory. I would think that these the original Sanskrit phrases are going to have a much more profound meaning. You could Google in any one of these words and probably get a paragraph of information, right? But it could mean, for instance, restlessness might have to do with a mental state of peace and profound connection with your higher source, and that anything other than that would be considered restless, you know, as opposed to sitting in the doctor's office waiting to get called on, you know, that kind of restlessness. So yeah, each of these has to be considered deeply if you're to have a true understanding. Okay. Right. Next, the Arhan, though he can see the past, the present, and the future, is not yet the highest initiate. For the adept himself, the initiated candidate, becomes chela, or pupil, to a higher initiate. This is pretty close to DK's teachings. Seeing the past, the present, and the future is called by DK continuity of consciousness, which is realized at the third initiation and perfected at the fourth. And certainly an arhat, or fourth initiate, would be under the guidance of a fifth or sixth initiate, as the fourth initiate Jesus was under the sixth initiate Christ. And finally, three further higher grades have to be conquered by the Arhan, who would reach the apex of the ladder of Arhatship. There are those who have reached it, even in this fifth race of ours, but the faculties necessary for the attainment of these higher grades will be fully developed in the average ascetic only at the end of this sixth root race, and in the sixth and seventh. So the teaching here given introduces the reader to the theosophical hierarchy of initiation. These ideas were later much more extensively developed in the Blue Books by Alice Bailey, who teaches that there are a total of 9 initiations possible in our solar system, though the 8th and 9th are rarely taken on Earth. The department heads are all 6th initiates, with the Buddha and Christ verging on the 7th. Higher cosmic initiations take the initiate beyond the confines of our solar system, which is bounded by the cosmic physical plane. Actually, I didn't really address one of the ideas here about the progression of the races. So there's a lot of numerical correlation between the race numbers and the round numbers and the chain numbers and the attainment that is possible. Also the nature of that attainment. For instance, a master of wisdom, one who attained the level of master of wisdom in the fourth root race would be, well, I should say this another way. One who attained it in this fifth root race would be much more developed than one who attained it in the fourth root race, even though those who did attain in the fourth root race would have come up through the intermediate time to that higher level, higher grade of consciousness by this root race. So he's saying that here that this level of Arhan will be much more common in the next root race, and even more so in the sixth and seventh rounds. So anybody who's initiate now is ahead of the curve of the, you know, the midpoint of human development by a lot, right? But even, you know, high initiates are far ahead of the curve, you know, sometimes spanning, like a seventh initiate is actually spanning 2 entire rounds ahead of the potential that is commonly available in this fifth in this fifth root raised to the fourth round. The, you know, the particular numbers are not important. The point here to remember is the general flow of how evolution proceeds. Okay. All right, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Tom, can you read that for us, please?
Thus, there will always be initiates and the profane till the end of this minor Manvantara, the present life cycle. The arhats of the fire mist of the seventh rung are but one removed from the root base of the hierarchy, the highest on earth, and our terrestrial chain. This root base has a name which can only be translated by several compound words in English. The ever-living human Banyan, this wondrous being, descended from a high region, they say, in the early part of the third age, before the separation of the sexes of the third race. This third race is sometimes called collectively the sons of passive yoga, that is, it was produced unconsciously by the second race, which is, as it was intellectually inactive, is supposed to have been constantly plunged in a kind of blank or abstract contemplation as required by the conditions of the yoga state. In the first or earlier portion of the existence of this third race, while it was yet in its state of purity, the sons of wisdom, who as will be seen incarnated in this third race produced by Priyasakti, a progeny called the sons of Ad or of the fire mist, the sons of will and yoga, and so on.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Okay, first, thus there will always be initiates and the profane till the end of this minor Manvantara, the present life cycle. So the term Manvantara is a non-specific term meaning great cycle, but as here used, it refers to a round of seven globes. There will be initiates and quote unquote the profane even at the end of this round, because even the planetary logos of which we are a part will not have fully transitioned to the fifth or soul principle until the fifth round. DK says, the heavenly man of our chain is vibrating somewhat to the fifth principle, or rather is in process of awakening it to life. His fourth vibration or principle in this fourth round or cycle and on this fourth globe is awakened, though not functioning as it will in the fifth round. So you see the tremendous numerical correspondence. Any thoughts about this? Okay. Next, the arhats of the fire mist of the seventh rung are but one remove from the root base of their hierarchy, the highest on earth and our terrestrial chain. So fire mist is the environment of the highest or Adi plane of the cosmic physical plane, as described by DK in a treatise on cosmic fire. Quote, here on the second plane, the sea of electrical fire, which distinguished the first plane, is transformed into the Akasha, or burning etheric matter. It is the plane of the flaming sun, just as the first plane is that of the fire mist, or the nebula. You'll also remember that in those seven stages of density that a globe goes through before it reaches its globe D, the highest was called the homogeneous stage. That would be akin to the stage of nebula or fire mist. Therefore, the arhats of the fire mist of the seventh rung are those great beings who are conscious on Adi or the Logoic plane. The root base of their hierarchy, the highest on earth and our terrestrial chain, would represent that higher octave of Shambhala that applies to the entire fourth chain. A stupendous expansion of the Shambhalic energy of our Earth globe. So let me make this clear that you have a Shambhalic point of focus at every level. The Shambhala that we read about and know about is the Shambhala of our Earth globe, Globe D, right? But the Shambhala of a chain would be an infinitely higher focal point from which all expansion, all evolution for the entire chain would be determined. DK specifically relates the level of Arhat to the fourth initiate, but Arhat can also be a general term. Here, HBB seems to be relating this level to a seventh initiate. Can we get a reader, please, for this?
Yes. Magda, can you read that for us, please?
At the seventh initiation, he dominates the entire sphere of matter contained in the lower cosmic plane, escapes from all etheric contact, and functions on the cosmic astral plane. The dynamic electricity of the first logos is felt at the seventh initiation. At the seventh initiation, he has power on all the seven planes and within the entire number of schemes. All the sacred words are then his, and he can work in matter of all grades, sound all notes, and control all types of force. He stands ready then to guide the life to regions outside the solar sphere of influence.
Yeah, he stands on the threshold, though it's still possible to take the eighth and ninth initiations, which there's even less written about. Okay. So next, this root base has a name which can only be translated by several compound words into English. Quote, the ever-living human banyan. The root base is the source of the will to be of the logos. In this case, of the logos of the fourth chained. The term root base suggests not only that source on high, but also the Muladhara, or base of the spine chakra, that thus encompassing both source, high source, and the root manifestation of the entire fourth chain. Can we get a reader for this, please?
Joe, can you read that for us, please?
The Absolute Self, our Father in Heaven, is but the absolute of our hierarchy, its crown, its summit, its glory, or considering it as the beginning of manifested beings, the root or the seed thereof. And as all nature works in bipolar phases, absolute matter, therefore, is the ultimate depth to which a spiritual impulse can reach in that particular manvantaric cycle. Below it are other complete hierarchies, while above our hierarchical Father in Heaven is the lowest plane of another but superior hierarchy, one of innumerable multitudes of hierarchies, which in their aggregate comprise the universal cosmos.
Thank you, Joe. That's why I like this image, because I thought it well illustrates the what's said here in De Perucker's Fundamentals of Esoteric Philosophy. So you have, you know, these three headed, which is the three in one logos of some solo logoi. But then you have his sources arrayed above that, you know. So, you know, we could translate this. This is, you know, in Buddhism, this is Avalokiteshvara, you know, the kind of ultimate God. But we can use it as an illustration in theosophy to show us, you know, for instance, the logos above the solar logos, who is the logos of that group of seven solar systems, of which our solar system is one, right? And then you have above that, and you have to remember each of these levels stands within the higher level. And then you have above that another three-faced one, which could be, for instance, the one about whom not may be said in the three aspects of that. And then above that, you have even two additional levels representing a kind of infinite progression of consciousness towards the absolute, right? So it's a favorite of mine for that reason. Okay, let's see. So using the metaphor of a banyan tree's extensive root and branch system, the ever-living human banyan indicates the interconnectedness between all earth beings from least to greatest that make up the manifested, differentiated reality of this great logos. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Michelle. Can you read that for us, please?
Now, this wondrous being is a spiritual banyan. To say that it is our highest self would be to use a misleading phrase. It would be doing violence to the facts. Notwithstanding this, however, in one sense, it is our higher self, our Paramatman. From it, we spiritually spring, and when in the course of cycles, the light wave shall have run its rounds on this planetary chain, into the hierarchical banyan again we shall be withdrawn. It is in very truth, so far as this planet is concerned, and so far as its thinking entities more particularly are concerned, our Father in heaven. The wondrous being referred to here must not be confused with the lower copy, the supreme initiator, the great sacrifice, the head of the spiritual psychological hierarchy of adepts, and the more immediate subject of our present study.
Thank you. Okay, hang on just a second. Close the windows. Any questions about this? Okay, here's another. Yeah, Joe.
Oh, this is anecdotal. In 1986, I traveled to India, and we went at Calcutta. We went outside to the temple of, let's see, Dakshineswar. And what I recall is that after we had visited the temple itself, we a group of about 50 pilgrims from the US sat under a single banyan tree, and the roots, you know, spread out, you know, probably as much as 20 feet in diameter above the level of the earth itself, so that you were sitting in the roots. It's just, I think that if one gets the sense of how large these are and how ancient, it may make a bigger impact on us as well.
Yeah, if you've ever seen a banyan tree, I also had that same experience, Joe, seeing these Indian banyan trees. It's really nothing quite like them. You know, they create an entire environment in and of themselves. So, Yeah, thank you for the anecdote. Is your hand back up? No. Okay. So, is your hand back up, Joe?
Joe, I'm lowering your hand. Please don't put it back up.
Too many cooks in the kitchen. All right. So, next up, this wondrous being descended from a high region, they say, in the early part of the Third Age. He's talking about, sometimes we lose context when we have some of these other readings. So this is one of the Arhats of the Fire Mist. Of course, he's going to be specifically talking about Sanatkumara here. And this begins actually a wonderful section on Sanatkumara. Anyway, this wondrous being descended from a high region, they say, in the early part of the Third Age, before the separation of the sexes of the third race. Okay, HPB gives more insight in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine. Can we get a reader, please?
Nadell, can you read that, please?
Vishnu, as the many-formed Brahma, and as Brahma, neuter, is one, and yet he is said to be all the 28 Vyasas, Vishnu Puranas. In every Dvapara, third age, Vishnu is the person of Vyasa. In the person of Vyasa, divides the Veda, which is one, into four and many portions. 28 times have the Vedas been arranged by the great rishis in the Vaivasavata Manvantara, in the Dvaivapara Yuga, and consequently 28 Vyasas have passed away. They who were all in the form of Veda Vyasas, who were the Vyasas of their respective eras.
Thank you for that. A little tough speech there. Okay, so in every third age, Vishnu descends in the form of what the Hindus call Vyasa, a great sage who reveals the, it's like a generic term. These Vyasas are different personages, but they're this office of descending into form. Is called a Vyasa. So a great sage who reveals the ageless wisdom appropriate to that time, to that age. The fact that 28 Vyasas have come and gone suggests that there have been 28 third ages, since a Vyasa comes every third age, right? So every third cycle, whether a chain, a round globe, root race, or even a sub-race, will resonate with the energy of what HPB here calls the Dvapara Yuga. However, the phrase before the separation of the sexes of the third root race specifically references this globe's third root race, when we're here told Vishnu in the form of a Vyasa once again appeared to guide humanity and create the current Vedas, that group of holy books. But we learn from DK that it was also during the third root race that conditions became optimal for Sanatkumara to incarnate on this fourth globe. Could we get a reader, please?
Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The statement that the great Kumara, or the one initiator, came to this planet from Venus is true insofar as it embodies the fact that he came to this dense planet, the fourth, in the fourth chain from that chain in our scheme, which is called the Venus chain, and which is the second chain. He came via the second globe in our chain. His scarcely felt vibration was sensed occultly in the second round but only in the third root race of the fourth round did conditions permit of his physical incarnation and of his coming as the Avatar. Very reverently might it be said that the first three rounds and the two succeeding root races in this chain correspond to the period prior to birth, and that his coming in the fourth round, with the subsequent awakening of Manas in the human units, find their analogy in the awakening of the life principle in the unborn infant at the fourth month.
Thank you. Any thoughts or questions about this? So, you know, there's differences between the Buddhic teachings, Theravada Buddha, and the initiations, and the nature of these vyasas that come in. Who were they? You know, and the information given in second generation or DK theosophy. But the main import is there, that these world teachers come into form in order to set the tone for the new dispensation. Okay, next. This third race is sometimes called collectively the sons of passive yoga. That is, it was produced unconsciously by the second race, which, as it was intellectually inactive, is supposed to have been constantly plunged into a kind of blank or abstract contemplation as required by the conditions of the yoga state. So the sons of passive yoga were intellectually inactive because they had not as yet been overshadowed by the soul aspect. This is, we're talking about the second root race and the beginning of the third root race until that great event where the Manasaputras overshadowed the members of the third root race, and therefore they became quote unquote true human beings. Can we get a reader for this, please?
Okay, but first, Ben has a question. He says, I'm going to butcher this, I'm sorry. Dwapara or Kali Yuga 10/20/24, he questions. He says, disagreement abounds as to where we're at.
Yeah, so what's the connection? Yeah. I would agree with you. Disagreement does abound, right? And how do the yugas correlate with this stage of becoming called a dvapara, which comes at every third cycle, right? I think they're, you know, there's not a direct comparison between the Kali Yuga and the Dvapara, even though both do represent a descent into deeper aspects of the form world, right? So, but the the next Dvapara, the last was during the third race. The next Dvapara will be a very minor version of that. In the next root race, the third sub-race of that root race, there will be a kind of dispensation that will come as a result of that. As terms of the Kali Yuga, you know, this is the bottom of the rung in terms of density. And I know there are yogis in India who believe, and this has nothing to do with theosophy, who believe that this Iron Age, this Kali Yuga, will end in 2025, that's the beginning of a new cycle, which is interesting given that we have the 2025 conclave and the set up by the hierarchy. So, and like I said, the Hindus don't have a direct connection with these theosophical beliefs. So those are two independent ideas that point to 2025. See another hand. let me see here. Yes, I see another hand, BL.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please, Nadal.
Just going back a little bit, am I understand that you were saying that Sanat Kumara actually took physical incarnation as a Vyasa, as sort of a world teacher?
No, I don't think so. I think he's part of the dispensation. I know I kind of inferred that, but I think it's a separate event. The Vyasas are very particularly connected with this third period, right? Specifically, there was a Vyasa that came to give, you could say, the latest or the most relevant teachings via the Puranas at the third race. Sanat Kumara, I think, is another individual because he has a greater role in Earth's evolutionary process, being the planetary logos for this globe, right? So they would be deeply connected, but not the same individual. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and he came in through the Venus line, the seconds rather than the thirds, even though he came in through the second chain of our Earth scheme to and via the second globe of that second chain to the second globe of our fourth chain. He was already here, but then was able to actually incarnate in etheric matter at the time that this Vyasa came in, in the third cycle. So during Lemurian times, because of the condition of the density of humanity had progressed to an extent that they could take physical forms by sexual physical forms, then that's when he chose to incarnate etherically. But for this entire time, he has been the logos of this particular globe. It's just that he was able to take a physical incarnation in the middle of the third root race. Okay, next, or anybody else? Okay. Did we read this? Let's see. I don't think so.
No. And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Hello.
Hello.
We might now briefly trace the correspondence in the second round and the second root race, showing how the law of cohesion was specially active at these periods. A condition of nebulosity, of a pronouncedly volatile condition, marked the first round and race. Movement and the accompaniment of heat is their distinguishing quality, much as in system one, but in the second round and also in the second race, a definite cohesion is noticeable and form is more clearly recognizable in outline.
Okay, so I included this because it was, she talks about a bit earlier, she talked about how all these conditions began in the second on the second globe and in the second race of this globe, and from that precipitated the third root race. Okay. Hold on a sec.
Francis, while you're doing what you're doing, Vivian says, is this all coming in the Far East India or in other parts of the known world? Oh, is this all occurring in the Far East, India, or in other parts of the known world.
Oh, you mean like the Vyasa would be, India has been a portal for the sacred, it has a first ray soul, and a fourth ray personality. So it has been a portal for these teachings. Now, I think the historical Puranas didn't come into form until the fifth root race, but in essence, they were given in the third and passed down from subrace to subrace all through the Atlantean times, and finally, the White Brotherhood, who moved from a sinking Atlantis to the all parts of the world, took with them this teaching, right? This great dispensation, and then it took many forms. And in India, since this tradition of Vyasa comes from India, it materialized as the Puranas. But it that same teaching has existed in other cultures, in the Yucatan, and in among the Celts in England, certainly in the Egyptian ageless mystery teachings as well. Another hand?
Yes, Joe, go ahead, please.
Thank you. I was struck a few minutes ago that the fourth ray was compared with the fourth month of a pregnancy. What that suggested to me is that the East thinks in terms of the mother, and the West thinks in terms of the father, and we now being in the fourth level here, aiming for the fifth, one might say, that we have the teachers of the East saying, and the West saying, we have to get these two together to form one whole. And there's been a lot of emphasis, at least in the Yogananda teaching, that it's time now to bring East and West together. And I think it's because of the way we have developed different thought processes.
Yeah, it's a good observation. I think there is, DK says something about the passivity of the Orient by comparison to the Occident. For instance, the meditation is much more natural to the Oriental, and active intelligence to the West. Of course, we're seeing, already have seen since DK's time, a tremendous merging of these energies. The Westernization of Asia and the East in general has it's not by any means complete, or is that desirable, but it certainly there's been a tremendous impact. And of course, we see the reverse too. The teachings from India and all over the East have become widely available and followed since the time DK wrote these books. So I think what you're saying is very much true. And we can also trace, I think, an odd ray line to the two, Occident and Orient. Though, of course, the humanities, the different cultures in both express all the rays, right? But you could make an argument for this soft and hard ray lines being connected with the Occident and the Orient. Next.
We have Magda, please go ahead.
Yes, the same concept of the union between the West and the East is expressed in Christianity, with the need of maintaining a center energetically and morally, meaning because the East is so influenced by a more Luciferian instinct, in anthroposophical terms, which are abstract ascetic life, and the West is built up on more materialistic Ahrimanic impulses. So the center is the only way, meaning like Christ being in the world but not of the world. But this is like easily said, because the left and the right, you know, it's so difficult at this point to remain in the center, and this is the conjunction of East-West that Decay says is necessary to reform and re-put together.
Yeah, well said. Ultimately, it comes down to the merging of first and second ray influences. You know, and the Christ has a first, second, and sixth ray, as many other avatars like the Buddha, all three influences. And so this ability to hold the will and express it through the heart is a function of the avatar, and it does express the ideal. So yeah, thanks for that observation, Magda. Anyone else? Okay, finally, in the first or earlier portion of the existence, let me get my video on here, of this third race, while it was yet in its state of purity, the sons of wisdom, who as will be seen, incarnated in this third race, produced by Kriya Shakti, a progeny called the sons of Ad, or of the fire mist, the quote, sons of will and yoga, etc. Okay, so mind separates, and thus bestowing mind on man removed humanity from its natural state of purity, which existed in the second root race. There was no sin as we understand it, error, you might say, in the second root race, because there was no mind to commit it. So there was an unconscious but definite connection with deity. The sons of wisdom are a highly evolved group that streamed onto this globe via the Venus chain and globe in the middle of the third root race. Well, actually, it was they came in the second root race but expressed themselves etherically in the third. The term Kriya Shakti comes from two Sanskrit words, Kriya meaning action and Shakti meaning intelligent energy or power. So it represents the ability to manifest one's thoughts and intentions into reality through focused action and willpower. The term sons of Ad means the first sons, as in sons of Aditi, right? And on a lower turn of the spiral, the sons of Adam has the same root, Aditi, Adam, and Ad. These terms, along with the sons of the fire mist and the sons of will and yoga, refer to the first truly human beings created through bestowal of the spark of mind. And the reason that is because the sons of Ad, or Aditi, or Adam, means the sons of the monad, right? It's interesting that the last two letters of monad are also Ad, right? So that the connection then was made through the Manasaputras that allowed for a direct line of the three principles, the monad to soul to personality. So if we read this passage again while translating the terms, while using the translation that I just made, we have, in the first or earlier portion of the existence of the third race, while it was yet in its state of purity, the sons of wisdom, the highly evolved group that streamed onto the globe via the Venus chain, who, as will be seen, incarnated in this third race, produced by Kriya Shakti, the ability to manifest one's thoughts and intentions into reality through focused action and willpower, a progeny called the sons of Ad, the first sons, or sons of Aditi, or of the fire mist, the sons of will and yoga, etc., the first truly human beings created through bestowal of the spark of mind. Okay. Any thoughts or questions? Onward. Next up. Can we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Yeah. They were a conscious production, as a portion of the race was already animated with the divine spark of spiritual superior intelligence. It was not a race, this progeny. It was at first a wondrous being called the Initiator, and after him a group of semi-divine and semi-human beings, set apart in archaic Genesis for certain purposes. They are those in whom are said to have incarnated the highest Dhyanis, Munis and Rishis from previous Manvantaras, to form the nursery for future human adepts on this earth and during the present cycle. These sons of will and yoga, born, so to speak, in an immaculate way, remained, it is explained, entirely apart from the rest of mankind. The being just referred to, which has to remain nameless, is the tree from which, in subsequent ages, all the great historically known sages and hierophants, such as the Rishi Kapila, Hermes, Enoch, Orpheus, etc., etc., have branched off. As objective man, he is the mysterious, to the profane, the invisible, yet ever-present personage about whom legends are rife in the East, and especially among the occultists and the students of the sacred science.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, so this begins, she's starting to coalesce this section on the Initiator, which she develops over the next many paragraphs. Gottfried de Perucker, which we occasionally quote, considers this passage and the one that immediately follows to be one of the most sublime in the entire secret doctrine. So, first, they were a conscious production, as a portion of the race was already animated with the divine spark of spiritual superior intelligence. It was not a race, this progeny. It was, at first, a wondrous being called the Initiator, and after him, a group of semi-divine and semi-human beings. So I see a hand before I get going on this.
Joe, go ahead.
A number of us were studying the higher path of the fifth ray just earlier today, and I can't help but think that this is describing the movement from ray four to ray five and all those sons of wisdom.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fifth ray is very much connected with the second principle. And this wondrous being, you could say, is an embodiment of the possibility of that principle, which is actually forms a passage to the monad and Shambhala, of which he is the head and one initiator. So, yeah. Okay. All right, so I'll get into my analysis here. So first we have, they were a conscious production, as a portion of the race was already animated with the divine spark of spiritual superior intelligence. It was not a race. Oh, I already read this, sorry. This progeny, it was at first a wondrous being called the Initiator, and after him, a group of semi-divine and semi-human beings. So the initiator here cited is, of course, Sanat Kumara, called by DK the One Initiator, whose established presence allowed what HPB here refers to as a conscious production of semi-divine, semi-human beings on our globe. This great group, which came in through the Venus chain and glow, Venus globe of our scheme, and which HPB tells us was not one of the numbered strictly human races, has and will make possible the lifting of humanity into soul consciousness. There's an extensive section on this great transference of energy from the Venus to the Earth scheme in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, in which DK tells us that this great event became possible because a tremendous triangle of force began to circulate the energy of three planets. Quote, our logos became geometrically linked with two other centers, of which Venus was one, and logoic kundalini circulating with tremendous force through this adjusted triangle brought about that intensification of vibration in the human family, which resulted in individualization. So you can see the causal link here between the coming in of the logos of Sanat Kumara and individualization. Okay, next up, set apart in archaic Genesis for certain purposes, they are those in whom are said to have incarnated the highest dhyanis. He's talking about that group that came with Sanat Kumara. Munis and rishis from previous manvantaras to form the nursery for future human adepts on this earth and during the present cycle. These sons of will and yoga, born, so to speak, in an immaculate way, remained, it is explained, entirely apart from the rest of humankind. So we see in this description the true meaning of the fallen to generation of such beings as Lucifer and Prometheus, indeed of all those great dhyanis who sacrifice themselves in order to initiate a new and higher cycle of human development. They were, quote, born in an immaculate way because either they only incarnated etherically, as in the case of Sanat Kumara, or they were able to project a mayavrupa onto the dense physical plane in order to, quote, form the nursery for future human and adepts. That is to teach and also directly stimulate the energy systems of those who showed the most promise among the sons of men. Any thoughts or questions? Okay, next. The being just referred to, which has to remain nameless, well, of course, that was in HPB's time, he's later became known to us, is the tree from which in subsequent ages, all the great historically known sages and hierophants, such as the Rishi Kapila, Hermes, Enoch, Orpheus, etc., etc., have branched off. Through DK, we learn the name of the quote being that has to remain nameless, which is now known as Sanat Kumara. Interestingly, HPB mentions Sanat, but not as being the one initiator who came to us via the Venus chain of our Earth scheme. Could we get a reader for this passage?
Gordon, can you read that for us, please?
Is not old time, the Greeks, with its scythe and sandglass, identical with the Ancient of Days, the Kabbalists, the latter ancient, being one of the Hindu Ancient of Days, Brahma, in his triumph form, whose name is also Sanat, the ancient. Every Kumara bears the prefix of Sanat and Sana. And Sana Ishkara is Saturn, the planet Sani and Sharon, the king Saturn whose secretary in Egypt was thought Hermes the first.
Yeah, so this is just an example of how he was mentioned in the secret doctrine. Biel, am I getting an echo? Are you starting to get an echo from my audio being on? Is that what you mean?
There was an echo when Gordon was reading, and so that's why I muted you. But I think it was his mic because it still kind of continued after I muted you. So sorry.
Because I can, no, that's no problem. I can mute myself if that continues. I had it once with Mikhail on a TCF webinar. So I guess sometimes it's more than others. Anyway, so more important than this is the idea that all the great sages and hierophants, such as the Rishi, Kapila, Hermes, Enoch, and Orpheus, have their spiritual source in this great being, Sanat, or as the following quote states, holds all within his aura, or magnetic sphere of influence. Can we get a reader? Here's a picture of him at Chart. Can we get a reader for this passage, please?
The planetary logos of our Earth scheme, one of the seven spirits before the throne, took physical incarnation and, under the form of Sanat Kumara, the Ancient of Days and the Lord of the World, came down to this dense physical planet and has remained with us ever since. Owing to the extreme purity of his nature and the fact that he is, from the human standpoint, relatively sinless and hence incapable of response to aught on the dense physical plane, he was unable to take a dense physical body such as ours, and has to function in his etheric body. He is the greatest of all the avatars or coming ones, for he is a direct reflection of that great entity who lives and breathes and functions through all the evolutions on this planet, holding all within his aura or magnetic sphere of influence. In him, we live and move and have our being, and none of us can pass beyond the radius of his aura. He is the great sacrifice who left the glory of the high places, and for the sake of the evolving sons of men, took upon himself a physical form and was made in the likeness of man.
Hallelujah. Thank you, Biel. Okay, so finally, as objective man, he is the mysterious to the profane, the ever invisible, yet ever present personage about whom legends are rife in the East, especially among the occultists and the students of the sacred science. So this sent me on a search. And I found one Hindu story which describes Narada, a great sage seeking enlightenment from Sanat Kumara, who introduces the concept of Satya, the ultimate truth, the eternal self, to Narada. This truth, Sadat explains, cannot be grasped through language or concepts, for it lies beyond the realm of names and forms. It is the essence of all beings, the unmoving ground beneath the ever-changing world. So that's the exoteric version. That's the available version of the teaching that went on between Sanat Kumara and Narada. You can bet there was a lot more to it than that. Okay, how are we doing here? We still have a little bit. Could we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that, please?
It is he who changes form, yet remains ever the same. And it is he again who holds spiritual sway over the initiated adepts throughout the whole world. He is, as said, the nameless one who has so many names and yet whose names and whose very nature are unknown. He is the initiator called the Great Sacrifice. For sitting at the threshold of light, he looks into it from within the circle of darkness, which he will not cross, nor will he quit his post till the last day of this life cycle. Why does the solitary watcher remain at his self-chosen post? Why does he sit by the fountain of primeval wisdom, of which he drinks no longer, as he has naught to learn, which he does not know? Aye, neither on this earth nor in its heaven. Because the lonely, sore-footed pilgrims on their way back to their home are never sure to the last moment of not losing their way in this limitless desert of illusion and matter called earth life.
Thank you, Vivian. Okay, first, it is he who changes form, yet remains ever the same. And it is he again who holds spiritual sway over the initiated adepts throughout the whole world. He is, as said, the nameless one who has so many names and yet whose names and whose very natures are unknown. So he is known in India as the eternal youth, teacher of the other three Kumaras, in the Near East as Pakalsadik, in the Book of Daniel as the Ancient of Days, and as Sanat Kumara among Theosophists, to name a few of his many appellations. This passage from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire describes how he, quote, holds spiritual sway over the initiated adepts throughout the world. Could we get a reader, please?
Joe, can you read that, please?
Did you say me?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Frequently, the force, energy, purpose, or will of a cosmic entity will utilize the vehicles of an adept in order to contact the physical planes. This method, whereby cosmic existences make their power felt, can be seen working out on all the planes of the cosmic physical plane. A striking instance of this can be seen in the case of the Kumaras, who under certain planetary forces and through the formation of a systemic triangle gave the impulse to the third kingdom, which produced the fourth by bringing it into conjunction with the fifth. These Kumaras, Sanat Kumara and his three pupils, having achieved the highest initiation possible in the last great cycle, but having as yet from their standpoint another step to take, offered themselves to the planetary logos of their ray as focal points for his force, so that thereby he might hasten and perfect his plans on Earth within the cycle of manifestation. They have demonstrated three out of the four methods. They are overshadowed by the planetary logos, and he works directly as the initiator in relation to man through Sanat Kumara, and with the three kingdoms in nature through the three Buddhas of activity, Sanat Kumara being thus concerned directly with the ego on the mental plane, and his three pupils being concerned with the other three types of consciousness, of which man is the summation. At the moment of initiation, after the second initiation, Sanat Kumara becomes the direct mouthpiece and agent of the planetary logos. That great entity speaks through him, and for one brief second, if one can use such a term, in connection with a plane whereon time, as we understand it, is not, the planetary logos of a man's ray consciously, via his etheric brain, turns his thought upon the initiate and calls him by his name. Amen.
Yeah, amen, right? Incredible stuff. Yeah, this is, I included this longer passage because it kind of shows the difference in the level of information that was given by DK compared to HPB. Any thoughts or questions about this? Okay, next. He is the initiator called the Great Sacrifice. For sitting at the threshold of light, he looks into it from within the circle of darkness, which he will not cross, nor will he quit his post till the last days of this life cycle. Whew. So the boundary of the systemic ring pass not is found at the upper border of the cosmic physical plane. From this vantage, the Lord of the world and the avatars he overshadows guides all sentient life upwards through the miasma of illusion, glamour, and maya found on the lower subplanes. Next, why does the solitary watcher remain at his self-chosen post? Why does he sit by the fountain of primeval wisdom, of which he drinks no longer, as he has not to learn, which he does not know? I, neither on this earth nor in its heaven. So earth's quote unquote heaven is made up of the four cosmic etheric ethers. Sanat Kumara's sacrifice comes through the fact that he has inextricably tied his destiny to all the sentient forms that make up the multi-layers of Earth's manifestation, which is his manifestation. We are cells in the body of the planetary logos. And finally, because the lone, and then she's answering the question she puts, why does the solitary watcher remain at his self-chosen post? Because the lonely, sore-footed pilgrims on their way back to their home are never sure to the last moment of not losing their way in this limitless desert of illusion and matter called Earth life. DK expands on this idea in Discipleship of the New Age, Volume 1, but this is a long two-page passage, so I think we'll pick up here in our next session. We'll ask this question again and answer it in our next session. So, yes, times for the next webinars. I know that TCF is just coming Friday, the second TCF
right.
of the month.
At 7 p.m. And that's the last one is 7 p.m. Then the next webinar after that will be Secret Teaching of All Ages on the 3rd of November, and that will be at 8 p.m. GMT. So everybody needs to adjust to the states in Canada going back to standard time, I believe Europe goes back to standard time maybe a week earlier than we do. So we may want to check on TCF. And then the next secret doctrine is going to be the 17th of November at 8 p.m.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know the exact date for your European time change. I know we have some attendees here through it living in Europe. So make sure and check your time if the times are going to be given for TCF based on daylight savings time. So adjust accordingly. After that, there will be the real times for those of you who live in Europe. So I know, for instance, Aunt Veronica and Vivian and a few others here are living in Europe. So, okay, you all, thanks very much for attending, and hopefully we'll see you on Friday.
Okay, Maria says next Sunday BST ends and we go back to GMT. So
next Sunday.
Okay. Next Sunday for the Europeans. All right. Thank you.
Oh, so TCF should be then on daylight time for you. So that shouldn't be a problem. Okay.
Yeah.
Bye.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.